Hello there, my friends. This is Tim Benall of BenallOfAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio. It is February 11th, 2006, and I am very psyched to have for you this week Steve Bassett. We sat down, we had a marathon conversation, spanned over 3 hours. We're breaking it up into 2 weeks for you. This week we've got a huge portion. We'll get to that in a little bit. I'm really psyched to bring Steve Bassett to you because he was, in a roundabout way, very instrumental in my evolution as a esoteric researcher and journalist, what have you. The X Conference opened the door for me to get into the UFO field, and the X Conference is the brainchild of Steve Bassett. He put it together, and it's where I met a lot of the great people that you've heard on Benall of America Audio already. More people that you're going to be hearing in the future. It's pretty much where I broke into the UFO field, was at the X Conference, and then subsequently the next year at the X Conference 2, and hopefully we'll bring you something crazy for X Conference 3 to try and up the ante a little bit. But anyway, Steve Bassett, he created the X Conference. He's with us this week. He happens to be on the forefront of the disclosure movement. Let me give you a little bit about him, because he's not just the founder of the X Conference. He's done so much more, and we're going to talk about that today. Steve Bassett's a political activist, founder of Paradigm Research Group, executive director of the Extraterrestrial Phenomena Political Action Committee, the XPPAC, author of the Paradigm Clock website, and a political columnist, commentator, and former independent candidate for Congress. He is the executive producer of the X Conference. Presently, he is the only registered lobbyist in the United States representing the extraterrestrial-related phenomena research activist organizations, and XPPAC is the first political action committee to target the political implications of extraterrestrial-related phenomena. Between April 19th and November 5th, 2002, he conducted an independent candidacy in the 2002 congressional campaign in the 8th District of Maryland. It was the first instance in which a candidate on the November ballot in a federal election openly addressed the matter of an extraterrestrial presence and the government-imposed truth embargo. He knows exopolitics better than anybody, so I'm really psyched to bring him to you this week on Benall of America Audio. This is a long time coming, this interview. I've been waiting to do this one for a while and hoping to get Steve Bassett on the show, mainly because of how much he inspired my work and how he sort of opened the door for me to get into ufology, and also because he seems to know what's going on. He has his finger on the pulse of where the UFO disclosure movement's going. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll. This interview was conducted on January 16th, 2006. Steve Bassett, part one of two on Benall of America Audio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Benall of America Audio. I want to welcome my guest, Stephen Bassett. He is a political activist, lobbyist. He's the founder of the Paradigm Research Group, executive director of the Extraterrestrial Phenomena Political Action Committee, XPPAC, author of the Paradigm Clock website, and political columnist, commentator for numerous websites, publications, and radio programs. Presently, he is the only registered lobbyist in the U.S. representing the UFO ET research activist organizations. And personally, for me, Steve Bassett is, if you want to give him some credit or blame, I guess, for inspiring me to get into the UFO field through BenallOfAmerica.com. I attended the first X conference and obviously subsequently the second one. And those were sort of my coming of age into the UFO field. And if it wasn't for the X Conference, I'm not sure if I'd even be doing this. So he inspired me to get going in the whole field and all that. So I owe him a debt of gratitude for that, and I want him on the show for a long time, so I'm really psyched to bring him here for everyone to listen to, and hopefully I can pick his brain some and learn some more about what's going on in the UFO field. And Steve Bassett, thanks for appearing on the show.
Sure, Jim. I'm glad to be with you. And appreciate what you're doing, and all the work you're putting in that website. I think you're ahead of the curve, and I think it's going to have an impact.
Thanks. Well, why don't we start off with just your background, your bio, how you came to become a part of the field, and how you got to where you are today a little bit, so people can get to know you a little bit.
Well, briefly, I entered the field in January of '96. I'd always been interested in the subject and the phenomena, but I was doing other things. But at some point, I just really wanted to get in. I wanted to get involved in something that truly interested me, that I felt I had a passion for. So relatively late in life, at 49, I made the decision that this is what I was going to do. I wasn't exactly sure how I would contribute, but I figured that would emerge in time. I began at the door that I went through was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research that John Mack had created, the late John Mack had created there, as part of his ongoing Center for Psychology and Social Change. And Peter, as it's called, was doing research in abduction phenomena, contact phenomena. John, of course, wrote about it in his book, Abductions, Human Encounter with Aliens, and later, Passport to the Cosmos. I spent 4 months there. It was very interesting, really exciting time for me. I enjoyed it. It wasn't it. The abduction field, per se, and the sort of the academic approach was not it. But I did figure out what it was. And it was in, I guess, April, May, late April, early May of, I am in May of 1996. I was in the office there, and I was thinking through my life and my interests and so forth, and my background in Washington, D.C. My family had lived in that area for many, many years, going back to the 30s, so I knew Washington pretty well.
Yep.
And it just came to me. I would engage the politics of this issue up front, in an upfront way, just straight out, based in, go to, from in Washington, D.C., because it really hadn't been done. There had been efforts to engage the Congress over the years. There had been, obviously, things happening in that town, to one form or another. But nothing formal, nothing out in the open. That would be my niche. Okay. I went down there, set up a quick office, and registered as created the Paradigm Research Group, which was the main entity which I've operated under for the last 10 years, and registered as a lobbyist for some organizations I'd contacted, such as Skywatch International and some others. Over the years, it's changed. Some have gone, some have come, but this registration was in some ways symbolic and in some ways quite real and important, because it was kind of an announcement. It was kind of a statement to the political media there and to the political operatives in town, of which there are legion,
yeah,
that this issue was part of the mix. It was real, and immediately I got attention for doing this. The political press track all the lobbying registrations, because they want to know who's lobbying for who and why and what's going on. This is news for them.
Yeah.
And I got interviewed by the Washington Post and others, and it began to attract attention. Okay, fine. That was a good beginning. And from there, I, given the resources I had, which were always limited, I did everything I could to put the issue in a legitimate, out-in-the-open context, as if it were like any other issue. Whether it be environmental problems, war, peace, education, what have you. And that eventually led me to create, a couple years later, the Extraterrestrial Phenomena Political Action Committee, XPAC, which was the first and still the only PAC that's devoted to the issue of the extraterrestrial-related phenomena. And I created a website for Paradigm Research Group. I created a website for XPAC. And at the Paradigm Research Group, I authored the Paradigm Clock, which was designed to sort of raise awareness of our progress towards a full disclosure or disclosure by the American government, the U.S. government, about the presence of these extraterrestrials. And that, so it was a political tool, certainly, in mostly the media. And that resided at one website, XPAC, and another website. Then the next step was really to engage in the election side of this thing. And I saw the opportunity to maybe get on a ballot in the congressional race in 2002. The campaign was called Disclosure 2003. I had a feeling that disclosure could take place in 2003. I thought it was another window of opportunity. And I was able to get on the ballot because of the hard work of a lot of volunteers. They went and gathered like 5,000 signatures. And I was an independent candidate on the ballot with the Democrat and Republican candidates. I think the Republican candidate was Connie Morella, and the Democratic candidate who won was Christopher Van Hollen. It was the first time that we're aware in history that a congressional candidate on the November ballot was speaking in debate with these other candidates openly about the ET presence and the need to get these issues out. That had never happened. So again, you can see how this is following a certain pattern.
Yeah.
Then after that, I founded the X Conference, which was held. The first one was held in 2004 in April, and the second was held in 2005 in April. And the X Conference stood for the first annual Exopolitics Expo, and that conference was in Washington. It was held during an election year, presidential election year, and it was intended in any way possible to bring the issue again to the attention of the political media, the Washington insiders, and so forth. So that has been, in a nutshell, my 10-year passage here. And the other thing I will mention very quickly is that one of the key aspects of this work is developing new language for people to understand what is going on and the political arena. We initially referred to the politics of UFOs. Eventually, though, I came to very strongly believe that the acronym UFO needed to be put to bed, retired.
Yeah.
Given a gold watch and a going away party, and told to go to Florida to a nice rest home and get out of our lives.
Yeah.
So we the next concept was we merged the concept of disclosure. I think I certainly played a role in that. It was part of my websites going back to 96, and disclosure was developed as a specific term with a capital D, meaning the actual event, the day that the United States government announces and acknowledges this ET presence.
Yeah.
Then we had the politics of disclosure, the process of disclosure, and then in 2002, exopolitics was a term that emerged from the work of Alfred Weber. He's now based out of Vancouver, Canada, and I immediately embraced it. And exopolitics is the term now that refers to the whole shebang, the phenomena, the government's posture, the people's reaction, the process of disclosure, and eventually the post-disclosure issues and processes which will be taking up our time. So it is a political journey. It was all spent primarily in Washington. Eventually, I started speaking around the country. I have spoken also out of the country in Italy. I hope to do more of that. And it's been a process of raising public awareness, political media awareness, congressional awareness. I've also engaged the executive branch to some degree. And there's so much more to be done. And the only real limitation to many projects and many more effort, much more effort in this, is simply funding, which has always been lacking, and hopefully that will change.
Awesome, thanks. Well, that's quite a bio. Well, let me start with one of the first points I wanted to make, and this was concerning the Paradigm Research Group, and I was listening to your keynote address from the first X conference, and you'd said that one of the things the Paradigm Research Group has been trying to do for many years is to show respect, acknowledgement, and raise the level of self-image in this field. And by the field, you mean ufology.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciate that and have a lot of respect for that. And some of the things that you guys had done was to, that first year, you brought some of the women who were speaking there to speak on being women in ufology. And then last year, one of the things I saw was the tribute to all the great ufologists who have come and gone in the field. So maybe you can speak a little bit to what Paradigm Research Group is, that aspect of that of your organization that aims to sort of like raise up ufology and give it a sense of culture.
Well, this is a very important aspect of the work of Paradigm Research Group, which is the Paradigm Research Group, the principal organization in Maine. Its role has been to support the field. That's the way I viewed it. It turns out that the principal way that's happening is through the political process, trying to get political resolution, but it's not limited to that. It's trying to assist the field in any way that it can. It's not a research organization, oddly enough. It's the Paradigm Research Group. The group in that case refers to the organizations that it tries to assist, which include research organizations, but also activist organizations. So it's kind of a facilitator, a bridge, a catalyst, that type of thing. And one of the very important but somewhat complex concepts that I've tried to develop and bring awareness to is that this issue is special in some ways as opposed to any number of other activist and advocacy movements, processes that we're familiar with, and that unlike any other issue, and I include that even the women's right to vote and segregation, in America, the government, for pretty clear reasons, began an extremely comprehensive and expensive effort to control, suppress, and contain the matter of the extraterrestrial presence and the public engagement with that issue going back to the 40s. They piggybacked it on the Cold War efforts, using the same structures that were built to deal with the Soviet Union and the emerging Cold War, which included the National Security Agency and the CIA and the National Security Act. They ran the gamut of activities that we often think of in terms of dealing with foreign nations and foreign counterintelligence. They ran that same concept with the American people itself. And what they did, they did a lot of things, but the way I like to describe it is that they created an intellectual ghetto. Now, this is something that governments have been doing and empires have been doing for thousands of years. If something needs to be contained, one way that you do it, you simply kill everybody, right? So if there's an element within your society that you don't like, you just kill everybody so that, and then you don't have to worry about it. And that was not uncommon either back, if you go back far enough. But that's something that doesn't work so well now, though the Nazis gave it a shot. The idea is you take the people, or maybe even the idea, and you create it, you assign it to what amounts to a ghetto. Sometimes it's a physical ghetto, and you build real walls around it, and you force the people to stay in there. Or an intellectual ghetto, where if you ridicule the concept, you associate it with things which attract ridicule, and then you build walls, so essentially build walls around the ideas and the people. In this case, the walls would be made of ridicule, of shame, embarrassment, and frequently refer to the ridicule curtain. And so that process began very early. It really got underway, I think, after the Robertson panel, which was held in, I think the Robertson panel was 52, late 52, 53, early 53, if I'm not mistaken. Formal program to intellectually ghettoize all things UFO. And they proceeded with that for the next five decades. And one of the ways that they did it, and one of the key aspects of this, is they needed a symbol. They needed a metaphor or a symbol, something that they could focus the ridicule on, that would be kind of the conduit, and then associate everyone and everything else with that. And it ended up being the acronym UFO. UFO ended up being the term, which is now virtually universally known. In other words, if you were to grab 2,000 people off the streets of the United States and ask them, do you know what UFO means?
Yeah.
You virtually get a 99-plus response on that, which is very powerful. There's not many things that you... I mean, if you were to ask 2,000 people, do you know who Al Gore is, you wouldn't get a response that high. So the name recognition is extremely high, which is important and relevant on many levels. So UFO is where the ridicule was aimed. And therefore, anybody who associates with UFOs in any way, shape, or form, whether you're an astronaut or a Pulitzer Prize-winning Harvard professor or just a person that works at Denny's and you saw something in the sky or a police officer, anybody else, it's a UFO thing, you're a UFO person, you're in UFO ghetto. And the effect of this was extremely good. I mean, I say good. It was effective.
Yeah, right.
It was very effective.
It's not good for us.
And not good for the people who want the truth in this matter, but good for the government's cover-up, prefer to call truth embargo.
So by the time I entered the field in 96,
this intellectual ghetto was well established. And there was, the effect is multifaceted. First of all, the people inside the ghetto, which again, the walls are which are not brick and mortar, but essentially what we call a ridicule curtain.
Yeah.
They suffer a lot. It affects their lives. It puts pressure on their families and relationships. It cuts them off from funding because the universities and the research grants are not available. Foundations won't touch them. So they have to operate in their own money until they run out, and then what they do, I don't know. And it's not comfortable there. And then there's a high level of frustration. You feel withdrawn. You feel cut off. And before you know it, you start turning on the people in there with you.
Yeah.
You can't take on the government. The government has got you contained. And so you turn on each other. You blame each other for failure to advance this. And, you know, hyper react to their mistakes. And it gets unpleasant in there. So it was clear to me when I entered the field that there was a lot of damage being done to these people, and the field was suffering because of that. So several things. One was that I felt that, and furthermore, and not surprisingly, there were those who would come to the field new. In other words, they weren't in the ghetto yet. They were on the outside, but they were thinking about getting involved.
Yeah.
And they would take the approach that, boy, all these people are messed up. If we could just get rid of them, right? If they would just go away, if we could just kind of purify the ghetto, then the wall of ridicule would come down, and the government would embrace us with open arms. And so they'd come in with this approach, and it's not an approach that I embrace. I think it's the wrong one, and I think it just does more damage. So I felt that, one, we need to pull people together to the extent possible, and we need to acknowledge them. In other words, they're not going to get any medals of freedom from the president. They're not going to get any Nobel Prizes. They're not getting Pulitzer Prizes for their writing. So we need to acknowledge ourselves. We need to provide acknowledgement as much as possible. And there were others that did this, of course.
Yeah.
But I tried to elevate it to a little higher level and take in more aspects of the work, the PRG awards, the Courage in Politics, Courage in Journalism, all the thing, that kind of stuff. So the awards that were given at the X conference, and the statement that PRG is trying to acknowledge these people, is part of the process of counteracting this ghettoization of the issue and buck people up so that they're more capable, able to eventually pierce that ridicule wall, which is essentially in their minds. In other words, whether you're on the inside or the outside, the ridicule curtain is in your mind. If you accept its presence and you react to it as a legitimate barrier, then in fact you will have to deal with that. On the other hand, you can just tear it down in your mind and say, I'm just not going to accept that I'm in this ghetto. I'm going to act as if it isn't there and make it so. So that was part of the issue. Then the second thing that I've been doing lately, in fact, I've talked about this. I'm going to be writing about this shortly. Articles will go out to a number of publications. Is hopefully beginning the process in which the acronym UFO is retired. It's put away. And I recently presented at one conference, and I discussed the fact that I believe that the era of UFO, the era of the acronym, the era of the concept of the unidentified flying object and all that meant,
yeah,
went from 1947 to 1991, and that was it. It was over. 44 years. And in 91, when the Cold War ended, it made it possible for a lot more inside-type people, government people, many retired, to start discussing in one level of openness or another what they had seen and heard and done. And so that witness emergence really began to drive, though it wasn't clear initially in the early 90s, it became clear, the exopolitical process, which didn't get named such until 2000, but in fact the era of exopolitics really starts to get going in the end of 91. And so the mantle was passed. And so the message I'm going to be getting out, and you're going to be hearing and seeing a lot more of this from me and from PRG, is that the UFO thing needs to be put away, and we need to be talking about extraterrestrials and their interaction with the government, if in fact that was the case. Their intentions. What evidence do we have for their intentions, their craft, their propulsion? The implications of all this, and of course the disclosure process, how are we going to get it forward, how is it going to happen, and the whole idea of, has anybody seen another, quote, UFO? It's just irrelevant.
Yeah.
Simply irrelevant. We have all the sighting cases we ever want. They're in the thousands. They're in the archives and the research all over the world. We don't need any more. Five people are welcome to go out and film them, videotape them, write up the sightings, interview the people, whatever, they can do that, but we already have more than enough. What we need is the political resolution of the issue and the information that the government has, and then we also need to raise awareness of the people in the press that this is a done deal. They're here, okay? That you can include that in a whole range of things. You know, are the Arctic and the Antarctic ice caps melting? Yeah, they are. Do we have some ozone holes in the sky? Yes, we do. Is there a war in Iraq? Yeah, as a matter of fact. Is there still racism in America? Yeah. Are there extraterrestrials here? Yeah. Okay. That's the way they need to think about it, which means they need to take the veil off of their eyes, take the blinders off the sides of their heads, snap out of the trance the government has them in. And by they, I mean the academics, the press, and the rest of the intelligentsia, who were supposedly the intellectual leaders of the country, who are, again, buy into, either unintentionally or intentionally, the government embargo, and get on with it. So that's the thrust. I believe what has to happen, hopefully what will happen, is the walls of ridicule will come down. The people that have been doing this work, how best they can, sometimes crudely, rough around the edges, will start getting acknowledgement from mainstream culture, and that they will not be shut out, but rather very significantly included in the whole disclosure process and the post-disclosure world, and that they will interact and work with some of the mainstream people who will emerge very quickly to say, yeah, I knew it all along, but I couldn't say anything because, you know, I just like my job and my tenure and whatever. And there'll be some sort of an historical transition here that is fair and honest, as opposed to being duplicitous and corrupt. And that's going to be good for everybody. It's going to be good for history, and I think it's going to be a feel-good thing. So I'm kind of committed to that, and it's tough because there's just a lot of resistance. There's a lot of people that, in one way or another, sort of try to convey the message to me that it would be best if all of the inadequately funded and not necessarily fully credentialed people that have been doing the best they can in this would just all go away, so that heavy-duty academic, credentialed, military, whatever, can come forward and sort of take the mantle from there and so forth. And I'm not buying it. I'm not going to accept that. So I'm committed to having the past and the present and the future come together in an appropriate way, so that the full history of this is properly acknowledged, and that the people that have spent lives with this work will continue to be able to work in it and be rewarded for that.
Okay, and then you sort of put a question in my mind here, but are you concerned that that's the sort of thing that could happen if or when disclosure happens, that all the great people who've been working on this for so long, that they're going to get squeezed out or not get any credit for the work they did?
I think it's definitely possible. I think that this event, remember, is the most important secular event in human history. Is about to happen. It's the most profound transition the human race has ever gone through. So the forces that will come to bear will be great and mighty. And obviously we know that in our society, as any society, there are very powerful organizations, very powerful people, very wealthy people who have the ability to move very quickly and take advantage of those things which are happening around them. And I know that the day after disclosure, the government holds this press conference, which I anticipate, and it can happen at any time, and says, yeah, we do have vehicles, we do have bodies, there have been engagements, so there is an ET presence here, and we're going to be able to tell you this now, we can't tell you everything, that type of thing. The day after that, huge corporations are going to be moving aggressively to capture the post-paradigm world. Universities will immediately move to engage the issue, and will start beating the drum about how they always knew about it, but they just couldn't say anything because they just wanted to. They wanted to go along with the government's embargo for national security reasons, and hotshot professors will emerge and become immediate experts on all things extraterrestrial. And they will, you know, think tanks will be created with big money from powerful people, and they will try to capture and own the post-paradigm and post-disclosure world, and they will view all of the work and the books and the efforts of the citizen science and citizen political movement prior to disclosure as an impediment to their ability to capture the new paradigm.
Oh, man.
And since virtually all of these people are broke, in other words, they've all spent everything they have trying to pursue this without funding, they have no money, what organizations they have are shaky and if anything, going away. Many have already gone away, like NICAP. They are vulnerable to this kind of suppression. And American people in particular, I think this will be translated globally, will be so excited and so focused on this new profound information and all that it means that they won't be paying much attention to that and may not even realize that the people that did all the, carried all the heavy water, did all that, carried all the water and did the heavy lifting, are suddenly just being erased in a way from the issue by powerful entities who may attempt to apply old paradigm concepts and morality and ethics to the new paradigm world and just basically take the same old nonsense they've been pushing for hundreds of years and just take it right into the next world, in a sense, and do the same old stuff, only do it with niftier technology and on a galactic scale or on a more cosmic scale, which would be a disaster for the human race.
Yeah.
There are people that want to take war into space. They want to take weapons into space. They want to engage the ETs and kick their butt and the whole nine yards, which, who knows? Maybe there's a validity to that, but they have no interest in debating that publicly. In other words, they're going to do all this, but it'll also be secret. And so what characterizes this transition is that increasingly there are people in the know who have power and influence who are planning their secret engagement of the new world. And so it's the same old stuff and invariably leads us into trouble. So one of the reasons I think that the researchers and the activists of the pre-paradigm and pre-disclosure period are viewed as a threat is that they have a lot of information which might make it more difficult for powerful people and in powerful organizations to spin the post-disclosure world.
Yeah.
And rewrite history in a way so that it suits their purposes.
Yeah.
And one reason to make sure that all of the, as much of the previous work is acknowledged and introduced and kept going, is to help the people establish a counter response to all this. So that they can have some input is to, are we going to go to war with ETs? Are we going to put nuclear weapons on the moon? Or are we going to, you know, view the galaxy as the logical extension of manifest destiny?
Yeah.
Which is pretty ridiculous. Yet there are people that think this way. I swear to goodness there are. So you can see the kinds of things that are at stake here. I mean, it's really massive.
Yeah.
So that's the utilitarian reason behind my concerns about acknowledgement and transition.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I totally see where you're coming from, and that's something I thought of, too. is what's going to happen to all the old guard when things go down. Now, you obviously, we were talking about you were a lobbyist on the UFO issue or for your own group, so you still are. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the general public and I honestly only vaguely have an idea of what a lobbyist actually does. So what goes into being a lobbyist for the UFO issue? What kind of stuff are you doing? Is it forming the PRG and the XPPAC? That type of stuff is what you're doing as a lobbyist, or in general?
It's all lobbying. The American people have a very skewed and distorted view of bad advocacy, and that's intentional. The powers that be, the elite organizations and so forth, have gone to some, I think, effort, taking some effort to confuse the people about advocacy, because by and large they don't want them to advocate. They just don't want them to do that. They want them to keep their mouth shut. Vote for them, right? Buy their products and pay their taxes. And keep their mouth shut. They don't want them to advocate. But, of course, they can't just say that because they have constitutional rights to advocate.
Yeah.
And if you said something like that publicly, someone would think that you were against the Constitution. So what they do is they just sort of pollute the whole advocacy concept with misinformation, which they do about a lot of things, including extraterrestrial phenomena and much else. Misinformation, disinformation. This is the essence of propaganda, but at a higher level even I think the Nazis had, because the Cold War really honed, both Soviet Union and the United States honed intelligence and counterintelligence skills to a fine edge, and still use those tools. So what people have to understand is this. That this is an incredibly complex world, and they elect representatives to Washington to try and create policy which will produce the best possible world and a country for us. The issues that they have to deal with are legion, scores upon scores upon scores of issues.
Yeah.
Typical member of the House or Senate is capable of maybe focusing on three or four tops with any depth. And that's given their staff and the Library of Congress, which is at their disposal. But the fact is that some might think the budgets of the Congress and Senate, or the House of Representatives and the Senate are too big. The fact is, they're not that large. And the staff and the ability they have to, quote, do research or be on top of the issues today is marginal.
Yeah.
Now, you want to increase their staff by 50-fold? Maybe. So what does that mean? Well, it means that the way that they're going to know what's going on and what are the issues, pro-con, the pro and cons of every issue out there, is that people have got to come to them and tell them this is what is going on as we see it, and this is what we want you to do. And in an ideal world, you'd have both sides being represented equally, or at least both sides certainly represented, and that they'd make their decisions based on principle and on what's good for the country, not based upon a golf junket to the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But those, all of the lobbying, all the lobbyists hired by everybody that wants to hire one, whether you be a rich oil company or whether you be an environmental advocacy group in California or group dealing with racial politics or affirmative action or a thousand other things, healthcare, those lobbyists are paid by groups to go to Washington and present a case to congressmen and congresswomen as best they can as to why those interests need to be served. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and it's absolutely essential. And say you've got a million farmers who have a real problem with the prices of their commodities and the foreign trade practices. What are they going to do? Are all million of them going to go to Washington and wander around collaring people and saying, "Hi, I'm Farmer Joe"? They have to hire somebody to represent them. And so what do they hire? They hire a lobbyist. Anybody that they, whether you call them that or not, if they hire somebody to go to Washington to try to get these issues across, that's a lobbyist by definition. And in fact, you have to register as a lobbyist. You can't come in and say, oh, I'm just an advocate, right? No, you have to register under lobbying law. So lobbyists are absolutely critical to the ability of issues by the scores to be presented to our government so that decisions can be made that actually make sense. The fact that there are corrupt lobbyists or those who try to buy people off, so what? There's corrupt mayors. Are we going to do away with mayors? There's corrupt governors. Are we going to no longer have governors of states? Yeah. Ridiculous. So, there are lobbyists. But the problem is that the public has been fed, disinformation about this, that they actually sort of think that lobbyists are bad, and therefore they think, oh no, we don't want to get together and hire lobbyists because they're bad.
Yeah.
But the fact is that all of the major entities in this country do, and so that goes on. It's not going to stop. But I think there are people out there, the average person, that thinks that, you know, someday there'll be no lobbyists, there'll be no political action committees anymore, and then things will be fair. And somehow the government will figure out the right thing to do without information, just sort of intuited from the ether. And so this is all ridiculous, but it's very effective for serving the interests of the powerful and influential, and very effective in de-empowering, disempowering the average people and their concerns. And the people have bought it. American people have bought a lot of baloney in the last 30 years, which is why the country, I believe, is going to hell. A lobbyist or a political action committee are simply part of fundamental advocacy. So I'm an advocate, and I use any tool I can. Now, key elements of advocacy are this. What are you advocating, and who are you advocating it to? What I'm advocating, which is stated on the websites, I think clearly, is the end of the truth embargo. Government regarding the fact of an extraterrestrial presence and the release of information to the extent possible about all of this early congressional hearings so that there can be so the balance of powers will be properly served. Who am I advocating to? Everybody that is in a position to influence policy. That includes the Congress, the executive branch, and more importantly, particularly in the modern era, political media, the people that cover all this, supposedly, the press. Fine. I advocate to the universities, except they're so obtuse and so walled off to their eternal discredit that it's pointless.
Yeah.
I mean, it would take big money to penetrate the universities. You know, the universities of America somehow lost their way. And got immersed in a swamp of political correctness, tenure worship, elitism, and became really a non-factor in some of the most important issues of our time. And why this happened, I don't know, but boy, they need to fix it real fast because they're embarrassing themselves profoundly. It doesn't mean that they don't teach people valuable information and that they're not producing degreed people who are functioning in our society. I'm not saying they don't serve their basic functions, but they have withdrawn from the major issues of our time and have also become, I think, to some degree dysfunctional. So I don't advocate much to them. Now, I'd like to, and it's certainly not something I would rule out, but I advocate to political media and the fundamental institutions in government, which includes Congress. United States, and there are opportunities occasionally to get out there and engage maybe the state level, but not much.
Yeah.
So that's the way I ask people to look at it, and I always come back to the same point. If you want to get this country going in the right direction, you need to not condemn lobbyists. You need to hire them. You need not to condemn PACs. You need to create them and fund them.
Yeah.
Right? And the Political Action Committee is one of the great tools that is available and legal in our country.
There are different kinds of these kind of organizations. Some of them are I think, not as healthy. The way they're set up, they're probably more likely to be corrupt. But the Basic Political Acting Committee, the PAC as we call it, 527, that answers to the FEC. It's an incredible thing. And anybody can create one. And it can accumulate money, virtually unlimited amounts of money, for advocating, limited only by certain basic rules, namely that individuals only, no corporations, American citizens, and a $5,000 annual limit per person. Now, what does that mean? It means that pick an issue that's pretty important to people, like healthcare. There's 42 million people out there who don't have healthcare. And they've been trying to sort of deal with that issue, and they've been coming up with half-assed, half-baked ideas to try to deal with this for years, creating this patchwork quilt that's incredibly wasteful and inefficient and impossible to understand. It's a joke. But whatever. Meanwhile, the number of uninsured just hangs out there, raising, going up every year, for the 42 million. And most of these people are not homeless or anything. They're working people, basic people. They just can't afford health insurance. Now, if all 42 million of those people were to say, damn it, once and for all, we want to get some proper health care in this country. We want to be a leader in the world, not a follower. So we want a system that will cover everybody for basic needs and preventative medicine and so forth. And this is going to transform this country. We really like to do this. I'm going to do this. You got to advocate for it. You got to put pressure on the Congress. Well, how can we do that? Well, you form a political action committee. Yeah, but you need money. Oh yeah, okay. Tell you what. Everybody, every single person that doesn't have medical insurance coverage, put $5 in the PAC tomorrow. Just write your check, send it out. That's about one. That's a happy meal and a couple of sodas at McDonald's. Yeah, $5. Every single one of the 42 million people that are insured can afford $5. Now, that means that PAC, call it the Uninsured of America PAC, right?
Yeah.
Would have immediately, without anybody in that defined constituency being in any way financially pressed, $220 million. Absolutely legal, absolutely appropriate. $220 million. And the uninsured, medically uninsured PAC would immediately become a 2,000-pound gorilla, and I guarantee you it would have impact in Washington. His phone calls would be returned, and it would be getting his point across. But these 42 million people don't believe they can do that. They think it's even wrong to do that. They continue to simply go along with the propaganda. They do not collectively work together. They do not advocate. They do not put their money behind their issue. And so these policies are then made by pharmaceutical companies that have dozens of PACs and hundreds of lobbyists and spend hundreds of millions of dollars advocating. And they always get their way. And the people who don't are part of that power group get nothing. Well, what can I say? It's true about medical insurance. It's true about extraterrestrial phenomena. If the people in this country want the truth, they could fund the X-PAC to the tune of $100 million tomorrow. If every single person in this country, based on just the low-end statistics, low-end analyses that we've done, who's had a contact experience, which we think on the conservative side is 2%, which translates to 4 million people. Every person has had a contact experience. Were to say, I want to get to the bottom of this, put $10 in X-PAC, it would have approximately $60 million from just the 2%, which represents 6 million people.
Yeah.
But that's $60 million. And X-PAC would be a major force in Washington, D.C., and the whole issue of disclosure would probably be resolved in no time. They won't do it. They have been mesmerized and entranced to think that they can't act collectively and they can't get results from the government. That's why they don't vote. 75% of American people don't vote. They don't think it'll make a difference anymore. They've abandoned their social contract. They're abandoning their rights and their powers.
And then they, but they still are consternated and upset when those who do advocate for policies take the country into directions which are appalling to them. And they get angry and upset. But they don't advocate, they don't act collectively, they don't vote. So in fact,